This is XTP Media.
Hey, Grant, what are you doing up there on that wreck?
Ow! Ooh! Ah! I'm getting prepared for Extended.
No, that's not what I mean. aviationextended.co.uk.
Oh! And say, look here, I have the skills. I could be a great fit for your company. If you don't do that bit, then you're not even going to get an interview.
So when I'm flying, I don't have to think about any of that. I'm just looking, concentrating and enjoying the view. And it's amazing.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 90 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. I'm recording this introduction today in an airport lounge, so apologies for the background noise. Today's episode is part of our Women in Aviation series, focusing on the roles and achievements of women in aviation and aerospace. We really believe that we've not done enough to promote this sector and hope that you find these interviews both interesting and inspiring. Our first interview is with airline pilot Lauren Wilson. The last time we talked to Lauren, she was the Women's UK aerobatic champion. In our discussion, Lauren shares with us the route she took to qualify as an airline pilot and some of the challenges she faced. Our second interview is with Cheryl Semple, winner of the 2018 Douglas Bader Fundraising Award. Cheryl tells us her story and how aviation changed her life. But before we start, here's a short message from Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian.
Hello, I've got just a couple of minutes to tell you about our new edition, TAH 26, published on January the 15th. Our cover story concerns an important test pilot you've probably never heard of, Wing Commander James Adams. He was posted out to California on the eve of World War II, lucky man, to evaluate American aircraft for possible use by the Royal Air Force. So if you've ever wondered how come the RAF never adopted the P-38 Lightning, even though they did operate things like Mustangs and Thunderbolts, this article will explain why. Another major feature in TAH 26 completes the story of the RAF's Far East flight and its tour to Australia in 1927-28 in Supermarine Southampton flying boats. An extra treat in this article is our second ever double gatefold, a page that pulls out to three times its normal width, containing a beautiful contemporary map of the route, plus colourised images of the flight's team. The name Sidney Cotton may well be familiar to you, as the inventor of the Sidcot flying suit, and perhaps as a pioneer of clandestine photo reconnaissance at the start of World War II. We've previously run a story about his nefarious post-war gun-running activities in Pakistan. But in this issue, we go back to the early 1920s and his extraordinary venture in Newfoundland, where he was the first person to use aeroplanes to spot herds of seal during the annual seal hunt. It's a spine-tingling tale of hardship and determination against impossible odds. Elsewhere in TAH 26, we've got Convair's Tactical Sea Dart project. Yes, a waterborne, nuclear-capable strike jet concept, using hydro skis to take off and alight. We've got the commercial and political tussle between the Avro 748 and the Handley Page Dart Herald. Dassault's experimental jet prototypes, such as the Mystère de Nuit and the Barugan, a backseat ride in a Panavia Tornado, and lots more. Right, time's up. Now, remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time then, this is Mick Oakey talking exclusively to Extended.
Okay then, let's get on with the first of our interviews with Lauren Wilson. Lauren, welcome back onto Extended.
Hey Peter, good to be back.
It's been a long time. I think when we last spoke it was 2013. You were the British female aerobatic champion at the time, and I think you were about to start your first season of air shows. I think you'd done a display for a couple getting married and were about to launch onto the air show circuit. What's happened since then?
Oh my goodness, it's been a while, hasn't it? Yeah, well, since then I've done probably 140 odd different air shows and displays across the country. I've gone off and I've got all my commercial licenses, I've quit my engineering job and I've started flying for an airline, and I've got married, and there's a lot in there. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Right, well, let me talk about moving into the airlines. What was the decision that sort of shifted you away from displaying and flying the pits into what you're flying now? Where did that come from?
Right, okay, first of all, I wouldn't say there's been a shift away. I mean, I'm not really doing much with the pits this season, just because logistically it's going to be really, really difficult and I've got to focus on the new job. But I mean, I certainly intend next year going back into display flying with some degree of vigor. Okay. And enthusiasm. I mean, displaying for me was never a career path anyway. I was always an engineer in the background and that's what actually paid the bills. But so the move really was from engineering into commercial flying, which okay. is something I'd wanted to do since I can remember, you know, walking and watching the aeroplanes going over, you know, as a small child. I always sort of like dreamed of flying aeroplanes, you know, and it was something that wasn't really that attainable and something that one of those like dreams you put on the back burner and forget about, you know, and you get on with life. And I just got to a point where I'd been doing some, you know, running my own sort of engineering business, small company, doing some consulting work. And I was just bored. I was just going to work every day and thinking, what am I doing with my life? You know, I'm not enjoying this anymore. And it got to a point, I finished a project and I had a decision to make. I had to either go and find another one or finally do something I've been putting off for 10 years. And my husband Simon was like, look, I'm fed up of you being miserable when you come home from work, go and get your licenses, and that was kind of that really. So off I went.
So what was the
a year and a half studying and doing all that, and now I'm not paid very much but loving what I'm doing, flying people around the country.
So tell us the journey that you had to go on. What licenses and qualifications did you do? Because from memory and watching you through social media, you had to go down into the Southwest and do some studying down there. Where did you study and what did you do?
Yeah, so I mean, I live in the Southwest with Simon, but fortunately I managed to talk to a company called Bristol Ground School, who do all the sort of the airline transport pilot license ground school study for all the exams you have to do. I mean, at that point, when I decided to make the jump over, I'd already got a private pilot's license, which is what I'd been display flying with. And I'd been flying for, 7 or 8 years at that point. So I didn't have to start from the very beginning like a lot of people do. But I wasn't very far up the ladder. So the first step I had to make was getting all the theoretical exams out of the way, which there are 14 at the moment, and they're all quite big exams as well. And the whole process, I mean, if you go on a sort of full-time course, which I couldn't afford the time or the finances to do, it's 6 months of very, 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 very intense kind of study and work. I did my distance learning with Bristol Ground School, as I mentioned, and I managed to do them all in about a year while sort of doing life and all the other stuff, and I'm still not quite sure how I managed it. It was horrendous. It was just the most intense. I mean, it made my engineering qualifications feel easy, frankly. It was very, very intense, and it was very, very hard going.
Did your engineering background give you any sort of lever up or basic understanding that allowed you to, I suppose, have a better foothold into that? Or
I think probably yes. I mean, having a technical background to then go and learn other technical subjects is always going to put you at a bit of an advantage. I mean, there's quite a lot of maths and physics involved, and so yeah, I guess it definitely didn't hurt. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And how did what did you have to do on the flying side?
So yeah, once the theory stuff was out of the way, the next step I had to upgrade my private pilot's license to a commercial one, and I had then to go and get what's called an instrument rating to be able to sort of fly on instruments, which is what you do in airliners all the time. And it's quite a different skill set from like the normal sort of looking out the window and just flying around that I was used to. So that was quite intense. That's probably the hardest thing I'd done. And then once I'd done those two and ticked those two massive, very expensive boxes, I had to go off and do what's known as a multi-crew cooperation course. So it's where you go from learning to fly by yourself and doing everything yourself to learning to work as part of a team with another person, which is obviously the next big step into the airline environment. And I went off to a company called Virtual Aviation in Cambridge and did a course with them on their 737 simulator, which was fantastic. Again, very intense and pretty bloody hard going, but yeah, very enjoyable. And I popped out at the end of it a completely different pilot, really, and with a completely different sort of viewpoint and sort of and ideas about professionalism and you know, precision in aviation. And it was, yeah, I loved it, I really enjoyed it.
And I think that's the one thing that's always come through from you, Lauren, is your passion for flying in all its different guises. Were you still enjoying it as you applied for airline jobs?
Well, I was quite lucky in that basically by the time I'd finished my course, I kind of knew where ideally I would like to end up working. And I was very fortunate to be actually offered an interview date before I'd even finished the course. So I walked out of the course, and it was about 3 days later I went and did my interview and sim assessment and was offered a job. So okay. I was quite lucky. This is not the experience a lot of people have. I mean, most people go through a long sort of winded process of interview after interview, and it takes ages and all the rest of it. But the market's quite buoyant at the moment. I say I was very lucky, and obviously managed to fluke my way through the interview.
Can I just stay on that point? You've talked about the market, and we've seen the global demand for commercial pilots increasing, but what do you think gave you, I suppose, that edge to get that interview so quickly? What do you think people could learn from your experience that might help them to also be in that position?
I think one huge element that actually a lot of people kind of overlook and miss is the CV. And I went and I had some help from a company called Airline Prep, who basically set out to help you prepare for how to do an airline interview, because it's quite different to any other style of job interview. I don't want to say a technical process, but it's a very regimented process, and there are lots of different elements involved. And it's not just I'll rock up and have a chat. It's quite an intense sort of set of things you have to go through, especially with a simulator assessment thrown into it. But to even get to that point, basically you have to have convinced them that you're worthwhile spending the time and money on having a chat with. And I mean, putting someone through a sim assessment is not a cheap process for an airline to sort of do. I mean, people like Ryanair actually charge money to people to go and do, you know, you actually have to pay for your interview, which just helps them offset the cost of, you know, what it actually costs them to go through the process. So I would say the big thing to get to that point was the CV, and Airline Prep and a couple other people looked at my CV and helped me sort of rework it and make it fit what an airline was looking for. Because my engineering CV, whilst it looked great for an engineering sort of company or job or whatever, would have been useless. It would have been thrown out. You know, it's not what airlines looking for. And yet it's sort of restructuring that and thinking about, you know, what skills do they want, and you know, how are they going to look at me when they read this one piece of paper? Because ultimately that one piece of paper and the letter that goes with it are the only things they're going to use to make a decision on whether or not they think you might be any good. And after that, it's just up to you to prove them right. Don't miss the effort on that point. Spend some time and some effort and maybe even some money on getting people to help you get that foot in the door and to sort of like, and to show yourself up and say, look here, I have the skills. I could be a great fit for your company. If you don't do that bit, then you're not even going to get an interview. So, you know, don't miss what seems like a really simple and sort of unnecessary step, because it's really, really important. And I'd say certainly that was probably the big thing with me is the CV, by the time it had been sort of rewritten the 10th time, I was like, wow, yeah, okay, I'd give me a job. So
you've been flying now in the airlines as a commercial pilot for an airline for about 6 or 7 months.
It's not that long, actually.
Isn't it?
I mean, I had a sort of survey flying job in the interim before, okay, while I waited to start my type rating course. So I did 6 months of that, sort of mapping, surveying, light twins and things, which was a whole different experience in itself, and quite enjoyable and quite a learning curve. But then, yeah, I actually started with the company I'm with at the moment in October, and I started flying on the line in December.
Right.
So it's not been very long at all, actually. Okay.
So what changes has being an airline pilot brought to your life?
Well, for starters, I am living in Aberdeen, which is quite a long way from Devon. So I'm spending a lot of time away from home. I've actually got a flat up here. I mean, I'm quite enjoying being up here, but being away from friends and family, and obviously my husband's is quite hard work. But it's only a temporary thing. I'll be moving back down south sometime in the summer, so it's not the end of the world. But yeah, I mean, that's been a big adjustment, and just like the roster, and getting used to working sort of, you know, earlys or late. I mean, it tends to be that here you'll start at 4 or 5 in the morning and you'll finish by like 2 in the afternoon, or you'll start at midday and you'll finish at 11, you know, and that's the working pattern. And the days off are, you know, who knows, you just wait and see what potluck brings you. So it's quite hard to plan too much socially too far in advance. I mean, I think we have about 6 weeks worth of notice on our rosters, which is pretty good, actually.
Yeah,
so
but
there's no real regularity with it. Weekends don't really exist anymore, so it's that's been a bit of an adjustment. But to be honest, it's whilst I'm up here by myself, it doesn't make very much difference at all, so I'm just enjoying doing it, really.
Well, if it's okay to ask you a little bit about your personal life, you're married to Simon, who's also a pilot, but a very different sort of pilot. Don't know if I'm allowed to say what he does fly.
Yeah, sure. He currently works for Leonardo Helicopters. He was a Navy Wildcat instructor and Lynx before that, and he left back in last May, something like that. And he now works for Leonardo as an instructor on the Wildcat and Lynx project. So he's doing pretty much the same job, but just on the other side
of the fence.
Basically, yeah.
He's also a Royal Navy Reserve pilot as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. So he still flies for the reserves as well, and he's very proud to do so.
And that's very unusual, isn't it? Isn't it unusual to be flying a Wildcat as a reserve pilot?
It sort of is and sort of isn't, but I mean, I think basically once if you have that skill set and you know they want to retain the skills as much as they can. So there are quite a few that do sort of come back and do bits and pieces like that, and it just seems to work well for everybody, actually.
Right, okay. And he's got a rich heritage in terms of some of the aircraft types he's flown, of course.
Oh,
with
goodness
the
me, yeah.
I mean, he
does a lot of fixed wing sort of fun stuff as well. Yeah, he used to fly the Swordfish for the historic flight and things like that, of which I'm very envious.
So the $64,000 question is, what's it like to have two pilots in a relationship?
Well, I guess it makes life a bit easier in that I understand how all the pressures and time constraints of what he does and likewise he does with me, and I think that actually can be quite a major hurdle. It's like, oh, when are you going to be home? It's like, well, I don't know, because like this is going on. It's like, oh, okay. And if you understand that at a core level, then it's just not a problem at all. So I think that works in our favor. But on the other hand, I'm sure as a social observer, it would be quite dull listening to most of our conversations at home.
Now you've also said that you want to go back to flying the pits again. Before I come back and ask you a few questions about that, what happens on the airline at the moment? You're flying the Dash 8. the Q400, I think it's more appropriately. What's the plan for flying with the airlines in the foreseeable future? Is it time served? Is it hours? What's the plan?
Well, for me, I mean, it was the aircraft type I wanted to fly. I'll be honest, like big jets and things don't really interest me all that much. So I'm absolutely delighted to be offered the job here doing what I'm doing. And I'm loving flying the aircraft. It's got its own character and idiosyncrasies, but I absolutely love it. I mean, for all its faults, it's a great fun thing to be poling around in.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I would like my intention is to stay as long as I can, really. And get a command, maybe become a type rating instructor or something like that. And that's what I'd love to do, really, which is just going to be a matter of time and not mucking up any of my sim sessions, really, I think is the bottom line. It's like you just work hard, study hard, and eventually, there's an hour's requirement on certain things to sort of tick certain boxes that I've got to meet. But hopefully that'll just be a matter of ticking those boxes and proving that I'm competent enough to be promoted, and hopefully it shouldn't take too long. That's my intention anyway, but we'll see how that goes. It could all go Pete Tong when I make a hash for some at some point. But
and what sort of routes are you flying at the moment? I'm being very selfish in saying this because I travel a fair bit to Manchester from Southampton, and I just wondered whether one day I might hear that announcement come over the tannoy.
It's entirely possible. I mean, generally from here, for the most part, I'm purely flying routes out of Aberdeen at the moment. But you do get moved around the network when there are gaps that need to be filled and all the rest of it occasionally. So who knows? I might end up doing a Southampton day or two at some point in the not too distant future. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, it's Aberdeen to somewhere in the UK at the moment, which fine and quite, it's quite good fun. So,
and do they do any international routes out of Aberdeen?
Occasionally, but for the most part, we're moving oil workers around sort of the country.
Yeah,
it's
right.
We're very much providing a commuter service here, which is good. And we're always busy, but it's not the most diverse of route structures, let's put
right,
it that way.
Okay.
Without sounding too scathing, it's like,
yeah.
But I'm actually quite enjoying the consistency of it. It means I generally get to sort of like be back home at the end of a shift, which is brilliant. So you can have a bit more of a lifestyle than if you're sort of jetting off all around the world all the time. But
yeah. And weather, not known for the best of weather in that part of the world. What sort of challenges do you have?
No.
With the...
So, do you know what? So far, I've lucked in, actually. In the really bad days, I haven't been working. I've looked out the window. I'm like, yep, glad that's not me today. But
yeah. I'm wondering when you feature on one of those crosswind landings that we see so much of on social media these days.
Wind doesn't count, that's fine. I'm sure I'm probably already in one of them, to be honest, but that might have been just a normal day.
How much hand flying do you do, is a lot? We hear so much about automation these days. How much hand flying do?
Do you know what, we're quite lucky in some ways, and the company are quite keen on people to maintain hand flying skills. It's actually quite a hands-on sort of aircraft, and it's quite easy and quite fun to hand fly, and we're allowed to, if we want to, choose to fly whole sectors by hand. Generally you don't do that because it's not very kind on the other person in the other seat, because whoever's hand flying, basically the other person pretty much has to do everything else, and the workload becomes pretty intense. So it's not massively sociable to do it too often. So generally, sort of you'll hand fly the takeoff and then whack the autopilot in and just sit back and kind of monitor that and make sure it's doing what you want it to be doing. And then depending on sort of like what kind of mood you're in, you might disconnect it you know, quite away, quite early on the approach and hand fly the approach, and that's quite common.
Yeah.
It really depends what mood you're in, but it's even managing the automation is quite. I want to say it's almost like a manual automation system in that it requires a lot of input and a lot of sort of understanding. I mean, obviously, it is actually physically flying the aircraft, but it's very much still being controlled by the pilots, and it's quite a nice system actually in that respect, and it's quite easy to understand what's going on with it. And if at any point you're not too sure, if it's doing something slightly odd, then you just get rid of it and hand fly it, and it's it's fairly standard stuff for us.
Right, okay. So the question about Loram Wilson air shows is, what do your employers think about you jumping into a pits and zooming all over the sky in the summer?
Well, they quite like the concept. I mean, obviously, from a PR perspective, I suspect at some point they may be making use of that. But we will see. Nothing's happened as yet. I mean, from their point of view, private flying is private flying, and you can do what you want. It doesn't count towards your commercial hours or any of that sort of stuff. So there's no real restriction on it. But obviously, what they don't want is for you to end up missing a day of work because you've got stuck somewhere or whatever else. So that's kind of the main thing, really. It certainly didn't put them off employing me, knowing that I do all this sort of slightly different sort of aviation stuff. I think it was very something they like talking about. Certainly, I fly with new captains occasionally. They're like, "Oh, you're the aerobatic one, aren't you?" I'm like, "Oh God, yeah."
And you're well known for championing STEM issues, and you're a fantastic advocate for women in aviation. What do you think can be done to encourage more girls and more women into the sector?
Oh, this is the perennial question, isn't it? This is the hot topic at the moment. Mm. I'll be honest, I don't have any good answers to it. What I will say is there's one generic answer that applies to not just to women, but to young, talented men as well. And I think it's easy to kind of think about the diversity issue and forget that actually the bigger issue in the industry is getting talent in full stop, whether it's male or female. And I think the big stopping point for most people, and probably more so women than men, just because of the way we tend to be thinking and being hardwired about sort of, you know, finances and everything, is literally how much it costs. If you've got to think about investing 70,000-90,000 pounds, maybe even more, into you know, just getting a bit of paper that might get you a job, that's quite a big stopping point for most people. Most people can never afford that. I couldn't. It took me 10 years, you know, and even now it's going to take me a good while to pay it all off. But it is so that I think the industry as a whole has a big problem with it just being financially unattainable for an awful lot of people. And I think that probably puts more women off, it probably puts women off in a bigger way than it does men in some cases, just because, you know, if you want to have a family or whatever else, then it's like, well, it's just not, you can't even think about it as an option. But I don't think there's no silver bullet. There's no easy way of sort of changing the balance or anything else. But I think if we were to start, if the industry as a whole were to start providing better support, better routes into jobs and into flying, you know, for everyone, not just for the women, but for anyone with the talent that they're looking for, but perhaps doesn't have the finances, then if you start doing that, then you're going to start leveling the playing field, and you'll naturally start getting more women in as well as more talented young guys.
Now, just to wrap up then, Lauren, statement on your website says, "I do what I love and I love what I do." Is that still true?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't. It's that I think the day that stops being true is the day I stop.
Right. Okay. Lauren, where can we find out about you on social media? Where can we follow you?
Right. Well, the best thing to do is just have a look for at Lauren Air Shows. So on Instagram, on Twitter, I am at Lauren Air Shows, all one word. I've got a website. It'll be lauren-wilson.com, I think. Although, to be honest, that hasn't been updated for a little while. And that's pretty much all kind of air show stuff. But I'm pretty hot on Facebook, on Twitter and Instagram especially. So go and have a look on there.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining us again. And can we come back and talk to you maybe in a year or two's time, see how well you're doing?
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Peter.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Now we get to hear from the inspirational Cheryl Semple, someone from whom we could all learn a lesson or two. Cheryl, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about how your interest in aviation came about. You're very active on social media, and I know you enjoy engaging in the sector. Where did it come from?
To be honest, I think it was the subliminal messages I received when I was very small. My brother was into Airfix kits, you know, the model aeroplanes. Yep. And they were on the bedroom ceiling, and I just remember lying on his bed when I was little, just fascinated by these things above me.
Yeah.
And he would always tell me what the models were and stuff. I was only little, but I don't know, you know, I really don't know. And I always put it down to that. But 22 years ago when I moved to Lincolnshire and I was driving along a road towards Scampton and the Red Arrows just flew in front of me, and I just stopped the car, and I think that was it, really. It was one of those moments, like, you know, one of those moments.
Well, I'm going to come back to the Red Arrows, actually, because they feature a little bit in your life later. But you're involved in aviation now. Mm-hmm. Tell us how that all came about then.
Well, I've got a disability. So I'd always wanted to run the London Marathon, actually, and I couldn't. Eventually, my disability literally kicked in, and I couldn't do that. So I knew of this charity called Flying Scholarships for Disabled People, FSDP, and I applied for a scholarship in 2014 and was successful, which was fabulous. And that's kind of how, I mean, that really did change my life. And in terms of aviation, that's where everything just opened up. I was suddenly in this world of aviation, and I loved it and still do.
And is it fair to say, Cheryl, that a few years before that, you were more able-bodied and this sort of struck you down? So it changed your life dramatically, didn't it?
Oh gosh, yeah, definitely. It's a progressive condition I've got.
Okay.
And I did degenerative things, so sadly, but well, not sadly really, because in a way I'm quite not glad I've got it, but I've got a completely different lifestyle because of it, and I would never have been involved in aviation the way that I'm involved in it without my disability. So yes, quite like you say, it's something that eventually got hold of me, if you like. I was diagnosed with this condition called hereditary spastic paraplegia, which is basically spasticity of the lower half. My limbs are very stiff, very weak. And I used to do a lot of running. I was a very active person. And just bit by bit, I just couldn't lift my legs and run anymore. So I've always been quite a determined person and a bit of a headstrong person, I suppose. So when I knew that I couldn't then go and do what I really wanted to do, I just wanted to find other avenues. And as I say, luckily enough, this charity was mentioned, and that was it. I just saw that as a challenge. And because I never thought I'd ever be clever enough to fly an aeroplane.
Right. Okay.
And I think that once I'd got past that thought process, then that was it. I was literally off.
Okay.
Thinking, yeah.
So how did this scholarship work? How did it come about? What did you get from it?
God, I got a whole new life really from it, to be honest. So that was in 2014, and it was basically 25 hours of microlight, fixed wing microlight flying. I learned in an Icarus C-42. the African Queen. Oh, she was gorgeous. She still is gorgeous.
And where was that based?
That was Old Sarum in Salisbury.
Okay. So you had to travel a little way for that,
didn't you? I did, But the scholarships are fantastic because you get your accommodations. It's all in with your scholarship.
Oh, okay.
And there's only I don't know of any other charities that offer that sort of scholarship, but we do, and it's brilliant. So for that reason, you don't have to worry about that. That's kind of, it's all in. You've just got to be able to get yourself to the airfield and from the airfield to and from back to your accommodation and to the airfield. You've got to be able to do that independently because it is all about you finding yourself. It's about finding yourself as an individual as well as learning to fly, but it's also a lot about being independent and building on your confidence.
Yeah. So what were the challenges that you faced learning to fly given your condition?
The worst was getting in out of the aeroplane, to be honest, even though the Icarus is really dinky and very cute.
Yeah.
Even getting into that, because I can't really push up properly with my hips and my legs. They're very weak. And I need to literally grab on and pull myself in. And, of course, anybody who's listened to this will know with any aircraft, you've got to be careful with what you're grabbing, what you're stepping on and what you're holding on to.
Yeah. And is the aircraft modified to help with that in any way?
No. Right. But you can have modifications. Do you mean in terms of getting in and out? Or?
Just generally. The aircraft,
yeah, they're modified if you can't use rudder, and that becomes a hand control system. I actually drive in my car with hand controls,
right? Okay,
because I've lost sensation in my feet, so my feet kept slipping off the accelerator and the brake, which is was never good when you're
not
driving and you kind of get them mixed up. No, so fortunately, I didn't actually need that when I was learning to fly. I didn't need rudder help, but you can have hand controls that will operate the rudder. But I was able to do that. I get the odd spasm where my leg would really jump up and down, which was quite funny, but I would say in terms of challenges, no, not really. It's that getting in and out, but that's no big deal. You know, you've always got somebody there that can give you a hand and give you a shove in the right place.
So tell us about those early flights. What were they like?
Oh wow, do you know, they were just fabulous. I can't really think of any other word to use. They were just absolutely amazing because, and you might hear this from other people, but I found that flying is pure freedom for me because I don't need to walk. I don't need to run. I don't need to look for trip hazards. I don't need to consider steps. I don't have to consider that ramp over there. I don't have to think that I've got so many steps over there before I've got to go down those stairs, up those stairs and round the corner. So when I'm flying, I don't have to think about any of that. I'm just looking, concentrating and enjoying the view.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. So the first flights, I think I did a lot of that. I did a lot of, I don't have to think about walking. I don't have to think about my legs. I don't have to think about anything.
Okay.
So absolutely fabulous. And the views are amazing, aren't they?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Don't get me started. Don't get me started. So let's go back to the flying training then. 25 hours. How did you do and how far up the syllabus were you able to get?
I soloed at 24 hours. That was close, wasn't it?
Wow. Yeah, cutting that one fine.
I had my instructor saying, well, I was going to send you solo at 22 hours. I thought, well, no, you weren't, because you would have done, wouldn't you? 24 hours, I know. And I knew it was coming. I knew that I was going to run out of hours. And not everybody solos within the scholarship. And by the way, you're not encouraged to go solo within your scholarship. It is all about learning how to fly and getting something out of it and building up your self-esteem and your confidence in you as an individual.
Yeah.
So it wasn't about that. I just enjoyed it so much and got so much out of it that I was determined that I wasn't going to finish my 25 hours without going solo.
Okay, so I remember going solo. I remember that feeling. As the saying goes, how was it for you?
It was amazing. Thanks, Peter. It was fabulous. I just remember my instructor getting out, you know, we stopped and he said, right, you know, you can do this on your own. And I never said, there was nothing like, no, I can't, get back in, don't be silly. The only thing he forgot to tell me, and I perhaps should have thought about this myself, was he forgot to tell me about the weight. The weight was going to change.
Yeah.
Which I should have thought about, but I didn't. So that was quite interesting. When flaps were on, I was approaching final. But anyway.
Well, the Icarus is very light, isn't it? So, yeah. So
it's,
I would imagine,
very light.
Weight and balance was a much bigger issue.
It was quite an issue, but it was fabulous. I loved it. I loved it. I was very emotional as I landed. I've got two sons, and I just couldn't stop thinking about them and how proud they would be of me.
Yeah, bless. Got any pictures, videos, or anything?
I haven't got any videos, you know, but I've got pictures. I've got a picture of me sat there with really red, blubby eyes. I'm happy to share.
Well, we better not put that one in the show notes. I should say you're also a successful model as well, so maybe we should do something to help promote that element of your career or not.
That's very kind, Peter.
Maybe not the one with the red eyes.
The red eyes wasn't a good look, I've got to tell you, no.
So what happens after the 25 hours? How does the process work after that?
Once you've got your 25 hours, that's it.
Right.
Sadly, you can either progress. I did 3 exams. You've got to do your ALO, obviously, to be able to solo. So I did 3 exams. I think again, it's just squeezing everything in within the time. You get 2 weeks of a scholarship, 2 weeks off and 2 weeks back on again. They've just adjusted the hours, actually. You get between 16 and 21 hours now, depending on what you fly.
Right.
But lots and lots of experiences, of flying experiences that are more encouraged. So, sorry, what did you ask me again?
Just it's okay. Forgotten. Just wondering what happened after your 25 hours. How did you then? Let's maybe take a different angle. How then did you go on to be more involved with the organisation?
I think I was absolutely blown away by how I felt about flying and how much of an impact it had had on me as a person. And I just, you know, I wanted to just do that thing of giving something back.
Hmm.
And FSDP are brilliant about keeping everybody kind of still involved. Once you've learned to fly, you're not completely let go of. You're still involved in some way, shape or form, because everybody, you meet people at Cranwell when you start the scholarship process and you kind of all link up. Suddenly you've got another 5, 6, 7 Facebook friends and suddenly you're talking about different things. And it's a lovely little community, actually. But sadly, in those 25 hours, you know, that's not enough time to get a license or to continue anything like that. And and financially, I just couldn't do that. So I really did begin to rely and was very lucky to be the goodwill of others, really, whereby I was able to get into different aircraft and do different things.
So what other aircraft have you flown in then? Because I know you've stood on the top of one, and that's a question I wanted to ask you.
The beautiful Boeing Stearman, yes. I did a wing walk year before last, actually. Yeah,
wow.
At Renkham Airfield, what a beautiful airfield that is as well.
So you've done a wing walk, which in itself is spectacular. Was that to raise awareness, raise funds? What were you up to there?
Yeah, to raise funds for FSDP, and that's I wanted to give something, but I wanted to just say a huge big thank you so much for completely changing the direction of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's exactly what they did. And without that scholarship, I'm not sure what I would be doing now. Life was very different for me back then. So I did the wing walk again to raise funds, yeah, it was really important for me to do that. Really, really important for me to do that.
Well, you've become quite influential, very successful in raising funds, and this was recognised last year. You won the 2018 Douglas Bader Fundraising Award. So fantastic, well done, and congratulations from everybody here. tell us, you've said it a few times, how your life changed. What do you mean? I sort of feel like your life dramatically changed, and that was one of the enablers.
Yeah, it did, because I got divorced in 2015. And I'm happy talking about that. It's not a problem at all. But yeah. I was married for a very long time. So the scholarship took me in a different direction, and it gave me the confidence to say, I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
So I did a big thing, and I stepped out of that. So and obviously with having a disability, it was my life is constantly changing. I suppose it's just because what I've got is quite slow progressing. It's kind of nipping at my ankles all the time.
Sure. Sure.
But I'm okay with it because as we're talking, the reason I'm talking to you is because of my disability.
Yeah.
The reason I'm involved in aviation is because of my disability. So I don't have a problem with it, really, you know. I really don't.
And you're a real shining light to others, and you represent flying scholarships really, really well.
I've only
ever seen you in that role, in that sort of ambassadorial role. So very much a role model to others. Of course, a successful model as well. So where does Cheryl go now? What are you up to now, and what's the future in aviation?
Ooh, you know, I don't exactly know, if I'm really honest. I'm going to keep raising funds for FSDP. That's really important to me.
Yeah.
to keep doing that, because I still feel that whatever happens, I don't know if I'll ever be able to give back to them what they've given to me. So in terms of, you know, that's just money, that's all I can give back to them, really. So I try and still keep up with fundraising, however however I can do that, and that tends to be just asking people for things that I can auction at different events or whatever. Also a little bit of volunteering work going on now with the John Egging Trust.
Okay.
Who I've got involved with. I love what they
yeah,
stand
they do
for, which
fantastic
is,
stuff fantastic
don't they just
yeah fantastic.
Oh my gosh. So I've just got involved with them, and I want to do lots for them this year as well. So however that's going to manifest itself, I'm not really sure, but in terms of whatever, but I think it's a little bit more of going out and speaking to people in the community about what the John Egging Trust does for young people. That resonates with me a lot as well. So flying, I'm buying a house this year, Peter. No, I know. And I'm very sad about that. I did some gliding last year.
Okay.
Which I particularly enjoyed.
It's amazing gliding, isn't it? Isn't it? Unbelievable. It's the most unusual sensation.
Isn't it? It's so incredible.
Yeah.
The peace that you have up there.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely beautiful. And you've got birds, you know, within, what's the word I'm looking for?
Just flying around, and you're flying amongst them.
Yeah, I was going to say jet stream, but that's the wrong word, isn't it? absolutely beautiful. The only thing is, with having a disability, and particularly a disability whereby if you stand for too long or you don't move for too long, you get very stiff.
Right.
Not ideal for me, sadly.
Okay.
So, and you can't book a lesson. You can't book a lesson slot or a time. You've just kind of got to turn up and wait till
that's right.
You know, your time to get on.
Yeah, they're pulling gliders around and that sort of thing. Not the best. Tell me about your love for the Red Arrows.
Oh, what's not to love? I absolutely adore the Red Arrows. I think it was that pivotal moment in 1997 when it was 1998. I tell a lie, it's 1998 when I was driving along the Sturton Road towards Scampton, and I saw them in front of me, and I was just smitten then, I think. I the skill that's involved with what they do is pretty incredible, isn't it?
Oh,
and what they've
amazing.
Done as well. As,
yeah.
They're great, aren't they?
Guys. Well, I bumped into Red 10 at Yeovilton with my daughter last year, and he was carrying a box of pizzas back to the team.
Why am I not surprised to hear that?
But I did. I yanked him, and he was only too pleased to come over and talk to Beatrice, have his photo taken with her. And do you know what? That absolutely made her day. It absolutely made her day. So, so they're a great bunch of guys. I'm sad they're actually going to the States because we miss them. but that's another fantastic thing for the RAF to do to put them on that world stage.
Absolutely. I'm just in awe of what they do, and I'm in awe of them, like you say, as individuals. They're all pretty impressive, and I've met them at quite a few events and functions and things, and they're only ever very professional and very, yeah, very, very lovely, all of them, actually.
But John Bond, Bondi, was actually our very first guest on episode one, I think, when he was flying the Typhoon. So looking forward to talking to him again.
That would be very good, because he was also a Tucano display pilot.
Oh, it was a Tucano, that was it. Yeah, he was displaying a Tucano, wasn't he? Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That's right.
He has flown the Typhoon,
yeah,
though.
He was Typhoon, and then he was the display pilot for the Tucano. You're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. Yes, he was. Now, just one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is, you're also a little bit of a lobbyist, aren't you, trying to advocate for improvements in airline services for the disabled. I've read a little bit online about the work, particularly with Runway Girl, that you've been
Runway
doing
Girl.
Just to highlight that issue.
I travel as a disabled person, obviously, and that requires assistance at airports, and that's a wheelchair for me at airports, because walking long distances is just too much, and especially if you know you need to be at a certain place at a certain gate. So I need assistance at an airport. I've had a couple of bad experiences, sadly, and I think a lot of disabled people have had bad experiences, and I know that's beginning to change. There's some brilliant campaigners out there that are changing, like Chris Wood, Mary Doyle, people like that, who have got an active say in what's happening, and I think that's brilliant. I just put my two penny within every now and again, because I've experienced what it's like to be parked up in front of a brick wall, because they don't seem to think that those that are assisting you haven't had proper training in terms of just dealing with disabled people. You know, we do talk, we do speak, we are, you know, just because we're in a chair, it doesn't mean we've been suddenly been struck dumb or anything like that, or we aren't able to have a conversation. So yeah, I feel quite strongly about that sort of thing, and I think that's a lot of that comes from being an able-bodied person not that long ago. It feels not that long ago anyway. And now I'm not that able-bodied. I'm not able to function as well as I used to. And I get so frustrated by the way sometimes you kind of get treated, really. But things are changing, like I've just said. So hopefully, and I think, you know, the social media world is brilliant, particularly Twitter, at getting right to the heart of some of these companies and some of these airlines, and saying, you know, it's not good enough and it's not acceptable. It's 2019 and it's just, you know, we all need to be looking at ourselves. And that goes with trains as well. I get frustrated with those as well. Don't start me off.
So, Cheryl, what advice would you give if you were starting out again?
If I'd been younger and I'd had a little bit of an interest in aviation, which I must have done at some point, I must have had something within me when I was younger. I think my mum said I would always talk about clouds, and I would point to the sky a lot. Whether that was I was just pointing at something, I don't know. But I do wonder sometimes where that came from. But I wish that had been encouraged, and I wish that there'd been more female role models around me to say that it's okay, whatever you want to do, you can go and do it. It took me a long time to be confident enough to see that I could go and do something. And sadly, it took me to, you know, my relationship and also with a disability to realise actually there's so much more you can do.
Tell us where we can find out about Flying Scholarships, and where can we find out about you on social media?
Flying Scholarships for Disabled People, they're on FSDP, or you can type in Flying Scholarships for Disabled People. They're on Twitter, Facebook. Don't believe we're on Instagram. Were, but that didn't kind of work out very well. So and a brilliant website as well, if you want to have a look at that. I'm on Twitter as Cheryl Semple. I know, original. Not
you're lucky to get your name that. Now, just make sure no one misses out. It's two R's and two L's, isn't it?
Yeah, SHERRILL is two R's, two L's. Thanks, Dad, for that. What a pain. And on Instagram, I'm Cloudy Cheryl.
We'll put links to you and to FSDP in the show notes. Cheryl, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight to talk to you too.
And keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Take care.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We've included links to both Laurel and Cheryl in our show notes, so please do go and follow them on social media. We'd really like to hear any feedback on these features, particularly if you've got a strong view or a contribution to make to the Women in Aviation discussion. We'd also like to hear from you about any women you feel are worthy of a mention in this series. We're really keen to demonstrate role models to younger girls and women considering doing something in the aviation or aerospace sector. That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course to Lauren Wilson and Cheryl Semple for sharing their stories. You can find Extended now on all major podcast players. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Gareth Stringer on Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you can find Tim Robinson at RAESTimR on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter as Nascot Hornet. You can also find me lurking around on the Flight and Audio Video Facebook group, where we promote aviation and aerospace podcasts and video casts. So if you're looking for something different, you go over there, join the group, and find out some new programmes. We've got some great content coming up for you on Extended, so do stay engaged with us on our Twitter and Facebook groups. It really helps us know if we're hitting the right content for you. And with the imminent arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Looking forward to getting on that Q400 to get safely home tonight. In fact, I wonder if Lauren's in the cockpit for this leg. So remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.